Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure to present this evening, or today, Wesley J. Smith, the author of Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. That's published by Times Books, copyright 1997. The ISBN number is 0-8129-2790-7. Wesley, welcome to our airwaves.
Thank you, Dave, and hello to your listeners.
As we are recording this interview live on the evening of November 22nd, 1998, 60 Minutes is going to be airing a piece of grim footage in which Dr. Kevorkian is actually going to euthanize a Lou Gehrig's patient on air. And I think that this represents something of a bend in the road with regard to the entire issue of euthanasia, which you have correctly termed a slippery slope from assisted suicide to legalized murder. I think this is not only a pivotally important issue, arguably, and feel free to disagree with me if you wish, the most important issue on the burner today, granted that there are a lot of important issues on the front burner. I think you've written one of the most important books that I have ever read, and I think you not only deserve a hearty congratulations, but I think members of the listening audience who care not only about their welfare, but the welfare of their friends and loved ones should make a point of reading your consummately important book.
Well, thank you very much. What's happening tonight with 60 Minutes is truly appalling because, in essence, we are having one of the most respected journalistic vehicles that's on television playing a snuff film, a film that Jack Kevorkian made not to benefit the patient in any way, and you can't call the person who was killed by Jack Kevorkian his patient in any event, but to aggrandize Kevorkian and once again put him into the spotlight where he very deeply wants to be. I am so appalled and disgusted that words almost escape me. And the fact that there are people who would support this as some kind of news event is just astonishing. I've been thinking for a very long time, Dave, that Kevorkian isn't really important in and of himself. Kevorkian is Kevorkian. I mean, every time in every era we have predators, we have people who don't feel they have to comply with laws, that they can march to the beat of their own moral drummer, and if society doesn't like it, they can stuff it. So Kevorkian is doing what comes natural. I mean, it's like a lion eating a zebra, you know?
Right.
But what really strikes me is our reaction as a society to Kevorkian. The fact that people still think of him as a doctor who helps terminally ill people commit suicide, when in fact at least 80% of the people who have gone to Kevorkian were not terminally ill. Seven of them weren't even physically ill, according to their autopsies.
That now a woman named Wants, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Marjorie Wants, she was his second victim, which shows that this whole idea that he only helps terminally ill people, which has been perpetrated in the media, has been false from the beginning. Marjorie Wants was the second person Jack Kevorkian helped kill. She'd been a mental patient. She had severe emotional problems. She complained of pelvic pain, but had nothing wrong with her on autopsy, yet Kevorkian killed her, and a jury found him not guilty because she quote, wanted to die, close quote. But let's think about that. Anybody who jumps off a bridge or shoots themselves or goes into a car, into a garage in their car and turns on the motor, wants to kill themselves. And yet we've always thought that as a compassionate and loving and caring society, our obligation as individuals and as a community was to help those people get past the crisis, to engage in suicide prevention, not suicide facilitation. But we are saying in this society that if somebody wants to commit suicide because they happen to have an illness or a disability, that, well, of course they want to kill themselves, they're sick, so we should facilitate instead of help prevent. And that's truly an abandonment of the most weak and vulnerable among us.
You write in the first few pages of your book that the basic purpose of human society, of binding individuals together, to live together as a common entity, is the preservation of life.
Exactly. And, you know, when I first wrote that phrase, which I quote in the introduction to Forced Exit, that was first written by me for Newsweek magazine in a My Turn section in which I describe how a friend of mine named Francis committed suicide with the help of Hemlock Society and actual encouragement of Hemlock Society literature, Hemlock Society being the premier so-called right to die organization in the United States. In my view, they're actually something of a death cult. I call them Heaven's Gate in slow motion.
Mm-hmm.
Because what they do is they have an almost a cultic fascination with suicide, with assisted suicide, with euthanasia. And in the Hemlock Quarterly, which is no longer published, they would print the poisons to take, how to put a plastic bag over your head, and that kind of thing, which my friend Frances, who was depressed for a variety of reasons, which went beyond her physical ailments as a 76-year-old woman, read and underscored, and I got this material after her death. And I was so upset, I wrote an article in the My Turn section of Newsweek called The Whispers of Strangers, which basically said you've got this group of people, which was the first time I thought seriously about the issue, in essence, who encourage people who are suffering from problems to take the suicide way out. And I stated that one of the main purposes of society is to protect human lives. And I got so much hate mail from that paragraph, which you quoted a part of, that I thought was uncontroversial, that I realized that something very serious had happened in the culture, and began to take a very much closer look at this issue, which has led me not only to deal with assisted suicide coming from a patient's rights perspective, a consumer advocacy perspective, but also now bioethics, which is the book I'm currently researching.
And by the way, you are the author, along with Ralph Nader, of a number of books about consumer advocacy.
Ralph Nader and I have co-authored four books, the most recent of which was a 1996 book called No Contest, Corporate Lawyers and the Perversion of Justice in America.
One could perhaps term the Hemlock Society the Let's Keep Up with Reverend Jim Joneses.
Well, it's very interesting. They are a energetic group of people who are focused very intently on this issue. But it's not just the Hemlock Society. The entire culture seems to be looking increasingly at death as an answer to problems. Let me give you just a small example of what I mean. There was an organization, and there still is, that used to be called the American Suicide Foundation. Now, the purpose of that organization was to educate on the issues for suicide prevention. But because we've become so confused about these issues, and I feel some of us are pushing the United States and Western civilization in general toward a pro-suicide culture, they had to change their name to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Now, there's a lot in a name. The fact that they had to specifically say they were about suicide prevention in this milieu says that something's going on in our culture that I think is a symptom of a larger problem, which is the breakdown of community, our loss of cohesion, our loss of mutual love and respect.
With regard to the actual issue of the slippery slope itself, one of the points you make is that the transition from what would appear to be, quote, okay, unquote, or acceptable, unquote, and those are obviously very relativistic definitions, is indeed a graduated and very slippery slope. You talk about a number of changes with regard to medical ethics and with regard to medical practice, and in particular, there was a change in the definition of intravenous feeding and the administration of water. Could you distinguish for us, or could you delineate for us the difference between compassionate care and treatment as it used to be defined and as it is now?
Right. There's a differentiation between medical treatment, which anyone can refuse if they don't want it, and humane care, which can never be refused. And let me give you a broad example. If I'm going to give you antibiotics as a doctor, that is medical treatment. If you don't want the antibiotics as a patient, you can refuse it. If I, as a doctor, want to keep you warm as a patient, and you say, no, I want to die by being exposed in front of an open window in a Minnesota blizzard, using broad terms here, nobody would allow the patient to make that, quote, close quote, choice, because that would be to deny that patient humane care, such as warmth, turning, and so forth and so on. One of the definitions of humane care used to be food and fluids. That is, we give you basic nutrition that sustains life. That was humane care. But it began to be seen that a way to end the lives of the most vulnerable and weak among us, and those which are the least productive, I hasten to add, was to redefine medical treatment to include food and fluids when it was delivered with a feeding tube. Now, granted, when you put in a feeding tube, there is a minor medical procedure involved, but the food that is put through the tube, which is a mixture of nutritions and water and so forth, it's not steak and potatoes, but it's still basic nutrition that the human body then assimilates to keep the body going. But by reorganizing food and fluids to be medical treatment instead of humane care, that allowed it to be ceased, to be stopped. And so we've seen, beginning in the late 1980s, people with severe cognitive disabilities, first the unconscious and now the conscious, who require a feeding tube because they can't chew and swallow to stay alive, are having their food and fluids cut off in terms of their, quote, medical treatment, so that they are literally intentionally dehydrated and starved to death. Now, the slippery slope about this is that when this was first proposed, people were horrified that we would kill people, and that's what we're doing. Killing means to end a life. That we would kill people through intentional dehydration. And the attitude was, well, listen, when somebody is in a what's called a persistent vegetative state, that is, they are diagnosed as permanently unconscious, and I hasten to add again that that is a notoriously misdiagnosed condition. But what people with the bioethicists and medical intelligentsia types would say, listen, when they're unconscious, it's not like they're getting any real benefit anyway because they're not conscious. And it's not like they're going to feel the anguish of dehydration because they don't feel anything, and so we can do that. Well, once it was decided that it was okay with the Nancy Cruzan case, in which the Supreme Court implied that this was acceptable, it very quickly, Dave, spread to the conscious, because what the, you know, the hand-wringing and the nuanced thinking that goes on in the ivory tower does not usually apply in the clinical setting. So very quickly, the message that was sent from the Cruzan case and others like it was very blunt. When somebody has a severe cognitive disability, the right thing to do is to dehydrate them. So you begin to see cases involving not unconscious people, but very conscious and aware people, people who can feel sensations, people who can feel pain, who are being dehydrated today in hospitals and nursing homes around the country without any objection by the law. Now, if a family member gets into a dispute, then there are lawsuits about the conscious, which are still being fought out, and I can describe a few of them if you'd like. Right now, if your loved one is in a persistent vegetative state and the primary caregiver wants to dehydrate that person, there's nothing in court or in law that can stop it. And we're now moving towards doing the same thing to the consciously disabled.
You point out that the PVS, or persistent vegetative state, is frequently misdiagnosed, and people have been diagnosed that way who later woke up.
Exactly. In fact, there's a case right now that I think combines these two elements. It's called Robert Wendland. It's out of Stockton, California. And Robert Wendland in 1993 was in an auto accident, and he was literally unconscious for 16 months. At any time during that 16-month period, he could have been dehydrated to death, and nobody could have stopped him. For some reason, his wife, Rose, did not ask that he be dehydrated during that period. Then in the spring, actually January of 1995, Robert woke up. He got to the point where he could maneuver an electric wheelchair down a hospital corridor. He could do some simple requests, such as, Robert, would you please give me the ball? Or, Robert, would you please take the ball, that kind of thing. He's very profoundly brain damaged. He's unable to talk or communicate in that sense, but he's clearly awake. He can clearly understand. He can maneuver a wheelchair, like I said. For some reason, in July of 1995, when he gained that capability, that's when Rose decided she wanted to dehydrate him. The Hospital Ethics Committee at Lodi Memorial Hospital in the Central Valley of California gave unanimous consent that that be done. And here's what often happens in these cases. The nurses and caregivers who know Robert best weren't consulted by the Ethics Committee. And the Ethics Committee decisions are all done in secret. You're not allowed to know who the members of these Ethics Committees are. In a sense, it's a secret star chamber, or at least that's what it's become. And once they give their imprimatur, it's supposed to be set in concrete. Well, a nurse was so upset by this that she whistle blew to Robert's mother and Robert's sister, who filed a lawsuit. And now there was a two-year raging lawsuit of whether to dehydrate Robert. The judge wanted to do it. He said, I'm doing the absolute right, wrong thing for the right reason. But he said, as a trial judge, I don't have the ability to dehydrate, order that it's in the best interest of a conscious person to be dehydrated to death, and so he wouldn't do it. That case is now on appeal. But P.S., Robert had a public defender assigned to him, and she got so upset that his, quote, choice, because there was testimony that supposedly he wouldn't want to live in this condition, that his, quote, choice was being denied, that she argued more emotionally for his killing than did his wife. This may be the first time in the history of jurisprudence that a public defender has argued for the death of a client.
One of the things that I find most disturbing, and one of the reasons why, as I said, I think that not only is this the most important issue before us now, but I think you've written one of the most important books that I have ever read, is that this issue is absolutely Orwellian in the most literal sense of the word, in that it's presented as a matter of compassion and choice, and it's not about either.
Right, it's about abandonment, and it sends a message that we should have a two-tiered society. One tier should be for the rights and protections for the healthy, the vital, the young, and those who are productive. And that says that if those people get into a place where they're in despair and want to take their own lives, we will engage in suicide prevention. We will do whatever it takes, including, if necessary, forced hospitalization to keep those people with us. We will give them antidepressants and so forth to keep them from killing themselves. On the other hand, we're saying that if people who happen to have a disability or cancer or some other illness want to make the same kind of suicidal decision, instead of saying, listen, you are blood of our blood, flesh of our flesh, let us help you get through this dark time in your life until we can find you going forward again with your life, we say, well, I'm sorry, of course you're sick, of course you're disabled, of course you want to kill yourself. We will not protect you in this circumstance, and we will allow you to be killed at your own request, and eventually that leads to, as it has in the Netherlands, being killed at the doctor's decision. I mean, in the Netherlands, doctors kill more people who haven't asked to be killed than who have asked to be killed.
And now people in the Netherlands actually have to carry a card saying that in the event that they're disabled for some reason, the doctor shouldn't kill them.
That's right. There's a Dutch Patients' Rights Association that distributes these cards. But what this does to us, and since we have a little time, what this does to us, and I'm hoping your listeners will think about this very carefully, I call it the new Jim Crow. Let's analyze what Jim Crow does. You know, the law not only reflects our values, but it tells us what to think. I think we can all agree with that.
And you are by training a lawyer.
That's true. Don't hold it against me.
Right. Go ahead.
What the law, for example, civil rights laws. Civil rights laws not only say that discrimination is wrong in the sense of actions, but they tell each and every one of us that we are to consider each other as equals, whether it's based on race or gender or sexual orientation or whatever. So the message of a civil rights law is that we're all equal. Now, Jim Crow laws had a different message. They allowed for differentiation between schools, for example, segregated schools, restrooms, this kind of thing. The message of the Jim Crow laws was that black people deserve less protection than white people, indeed that black people were inferior to white people. Therefore, while the Jim Crow laws did not legalize the horrors of things such as lynching and race riots against black communities, but they created the message that said that black lives are of less inherent moral worth than white lives, so when these terrible things happen, even though they're technically illegal, we will shrug our shoulders and think they are of little consequence. Well, the same thing will happen if we legalize in the bedrock of law that some people's lives are so unworthy of being lived that the society loses its stake in protecting their lives, even from self-destruction. And we are already beginning to see that attitude in the way we treat disabled people and in the way doctors are now proclaiming a right to refuse desired medical treatment that people who are dying or people who are profoundly disabled want. It very quickly goes from a position of choice, that is, I don't want to live anymore so the doctor can help kill me, to you have a duty to die.
That's also, by the way, excuse me for interrupting, but that's also applying to elderly people and infants born with severe disabilities.
Absolutely. In fact, even not so severe disabilities, such as Down syndrome. So you've got a problem here when you know, the whole problem of man's and woman's history, humankind's history, is that we have found a way to create the other. whether it's based on tribe, whether it's based on religion, whether it's based on race, whether it's based on gender, whether it's based on sexual orientation, we seem to always want to find an other that we can oppress and sometimes even kill. I see in this current assisted suicide debate, euthanasia debate, and in the coming problems in bioethics, that is feudal care theory, where doctors are saying I can refuse treatment to people who's, when my values say that the quality of their lives make their life not worth living. And we can talk about that if you want. But what I see happening now is we're creating a form of other based on health and ability or disability. It might be called healthism. I don't know. I don't know what term would apply. But we are saying that the lives of some people aren't worth living and the lives of others are, and we treat those two types of lives differently, creating a different expectation in society and a different value system toward those various lives based on these kinds of judgments. And it's extremely dangerous, especially in a world of HMOs and managed care, where money is made and profit is made in medicine from cutting costs.
We're going to talk about various ways in which the practice and theory of medicine is being redefined in connection with the slippery slope. But before we leave the issue of the switch from compassionate care and treatment, which is one of the many Orwellian aspects of this, I want to read a quote that you have in Forced Exit from a Dr. William Burke, who describes what death by dehydration is like. Oh, by the way, before I read this, you also cite a British study which found that many people who were viewed by physicians as having PVS, or so-called brain damaged, or vegetables, actually were conscious but couldn't communicate.
Right, it's called the locked-in syndrome. And if I can gently correct you about something, I really don't like the term vegetable. It's a pejorative, in my view, very similar to the N-word or any other word that is used to dehumanize somebody. No human being is a vegetable. We may be disabled, we may be unconscious, but none of us is a vegetable.
Yeah, no, that is something that's in popular use, but I did not mean it as a value judgment.
I understand that,
but
I think in terms of, we have to correct our language in that sense, that we have to start thinking of each and every one of us as having equal worth. I don't care if you're unconscious, disabled, or the President of the United States, each of us has equal inherent moral worth.
Right. Now, bear in mind that what I'm about to read is legal. And bear in mind, too, the Orwellian aspects. This is the entire right to die movement is being presented as a matter of choice and compassion. And I will leave it up to the audience to decide whether or not what I'm about to read constitutes compassion. You quoted Dr. William Burke describing what death by dehydration is like. And he says, quote, "A conscious person would feel it, dehydration, just as you or I would. They will go into seizures. Their skin cracks, their tongue cracks, their lips crack. They may have nosebleeds because of the drying of the mucous membranes, and heaving, and vomiting might ensue because of the drying out of the stomach lining. They feel the pangs of hunger and thirst. Imagine going one day without a glass of water. Death by dehydration takes 10 to 14 days. It is an extremely agonizing death, and I would add one that is now legal." Now, with regard to the...
It's interesting. If we did that to a horse, mm-hmm. we'd go to jail. But if we do it to a cognitively disabled human being, we're considered compassionate.
Already, we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left in this half of the interview, Wesley, and I'd like to cite an historical element that has relevance to one of the changing aspects of the theory and practice of medicine. Euthanasia reared its ugly head in Germany in the Hitler period, and one of the changes was the responsibility of the doctor was viewed as being primarily to the state rather than to the patient. Would you develop that further for us?
Right. In fact, we have to go back further than the Hitler period. The promotion of euthanasia and assisted suicide in Germany began actually before the turn of the century, but it really hit its stride in 1920, and this is long before Hitler was ever dreamed of really being the leader of Germany. A doctor named Alfred Hoke and a professor of law named Carl Binding wrote a book called Permission to Destroy Life Unworthy of Life. And they set forth three categories of people who could be killed, and they used the term right to die in that book, which may be the time when the term was coined. I'm not sure. I've not seen the term used any time before 1920 in this book, but they definitely use it in this book. And the three categories of people who they believe should and can ethically be killed are the terminally ill, terminally wounded, mortally wounded, as they put it. That's the first category. And we're already seeing great effort to legalize it now in the United States, which is identical to what they were talking about in Germany in 1920. They said the unconscious and we're already killing people who are unconscious by dehydration. And the third was the people they term the idiots and the disabled. I don't like the term idiot, although it's a technical term, I suppose. But they said the disabled who are a burden to the society to keep alive, and they went through this great cost analysis, a very utilitarian kind of cost and benefit kind of analysis, and we're seeing that very same thing today. When you see people like Governor Richard Lamb, the former governor of Colorado, who calls for the mandatory cessation of medical treatment from certain people if they're disabled and so forth, based on the fact that other people may not be covered by health insurance. So what we're saying is we're going to sacrifice some people under the Governor Lamb prescription. We'll sacrifice the weak and the vulnerable and the disabled to benefit the healthy and the vital and the young. And it's a very dangerous thing, but that was what happened in Germany. So by 1927, this book, Permission to Destroy Life Unworthy of Life, which had nothing to do with Nazis or the Nazi Party, which was really not that much of an influence at that time, by 1927 there was a poll that showed that 75% of German parents of disabled children thought it should be okay for doctors to kill their children if the killing was done painlessly. So by the time Hitler took power in 1933, the German society was already prepped for supporting assisted suicide and euthanasia. He tried to legalize it in 1933 or 34, and the German churches objected, so it wasn't done. Fast forward to 1939, in which a child is born in Germany with birth defects, having stunted limbs. And the father of that child writes to Chancellor Hitler and says that, in essence, you know, we've got this child who has these disabilities. We want that child killed. Hitler sent one of his personal physicians, Karl Brandt, to investigate this. And Karl Brandt found, yes, this child was born with the disabilities, and told the doctors of the child, if you kill this child, nothing will happen to you legally. The child was murdered, and that's the only thing you can call it. It was murdered. He was murdered. And the father said that we can now have healthier children, and it will benefit us in the future. That led to, this was voluntary euthanasia of a disabled child at the request of the father. That led Hitler to write a secret executive order for doctors to not be forced to, but to be allowed to kill children who were born with disabilities, which began the euthanasia holocaust that went for 6 years between 1939 and 1945. Between 200 and 350,000 disabled children and adults were murdered because they were disabled. And that all is traced back to the book in 1920, pre-Hitler, pre-Nazis, in which it was determined that there should be permission to destroy life unworthy of life. And that book by Binding and Hoke is very similar to the advocacy you're seeing today.
And we're going to talk about that and some other disturbing parallels between some of the cultural and historical trends in Germany and what we're seeing today in the United States in just a minute. We have been visiting with Wesley J. Smith, the author of Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder, published by Times Books, copyright 1997, and we will join Mr. Smith for another half hour of discussion on the other side of this tape. For Wesley Smith, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.